Our collective nightmare, a hot July night in 1952. Fighter jets idling on the tarmac like tired dogs, radar screens suddenly full of things that behaved like they had minds. Pilots were vectored into a sky that refused to obey the rules we wrote for it. Lights appeared, held position, closed in on an interceptor until the pilot considered firing into the unknown. The lights vanished. The blips on the scopes blinked in and out. Authorities had explanations at the ready. Mirage of a mirror, bad weather, and overworked imagination. And then other authorities, the ones who watched the screens with decades of experience, said no. They said the returns looked solid. Newspapers exploded. The Washington flap became a circus. Men in suits gave polished briefings that sounded like reassurance but read like negligence. A famed scientist acknowledged that people had seen things and then shrugged in the way society shrugs when evidence meets the machinery of denial. The official project cataloged thousands of sightings, then shut its doors with 700 cases still labeled unknown. Unknown, which in government language means file it away, move on, make it go away. The story did not die, it multiplied. Pilots keep reporting machines that move like ideas, not like planes. Radar operators keep seeing things that radar was not supposed to show. Modern bureaucracies have been invented to study the problem. New acronyms have been stamped on reports like stamps on passport photos of the inexplicable. The language has been cleaned up, sanitized into offices with nicer chairs and new logos. The bottom line got prettier. If a pilot sees something today, call local law enforcement. That is the punchline. Decades of scrambled jets and midnight interrogations, technicians arguing in towers, a nervous commander asking whether to shoot at an unidentified light, and the current guidance as to dial 911. An entire history of lives flashing past scopes, of pilots burning fuel pursuing ghosts, of radar specialists insisting they saw real returns, reduced to the same advice you get for a neighbor's suspicious package. There is a pattern here that comforts nobody. When cheap terror meets inconvenient truth, we prefer stories that tidy up complexity into weather charts and misread instruments. When complexity refuses to be tidy, we invent offices, issue press releases, and remember to fund nothing that would actually answer the hard question. We build committees and tell the people who saw it to write it down on a form. Meanwhile, the lights keep returning. The pilots who chased them then and the pilots who chase them now are left with the same loneliness at altitude, instruments telling them one story, the sky telling another, and a country that treats the unknown like a municipal problem. The rage should be simple. We have the tools of science and the resources of the richest nation on Earth, and our plan for unexplained things in our airspace is to delegate to local cops and hope a calmer narrative takes over the next morning's headlines. There is poetry in the absurdity. We armed a generation to fight bombers and then watched our own watches betray us. We trained men to split seconds and make decisions that can kill, then offered them theology and PR when the things they chased refused to be cataloged. The records call it a curiosity. The pilots call it threat. The public calls it a spectacle. The government calls it paperwork. No conclusion will be neat. The lights are not reputable. The bureaucrats are. The pilots keep their report forms. The public keeps reading sensational headlines. The machines keep returning returns. If anything, the moral is tired and sharp. The country that can land robots on far-off rocks will still tell its citizens to call the local police when something inexplicable moves over the capital. It is a pragmatic answer from institutions that have long since stopped pretending they will protect us from intelligent mysteries.
Brigitte Bardot died at 91, which in the modern First World playbook means three things at once: immediate condolence posts, immediate merchandise collaborations, and immediate arguments about whether anyone's allowed to like her anymore. She was the original influencer. Made a cover photo at 15, invented the tousled "I woke up like this" look decades before it came with a filter, and turned a fishing village into a lifestyle resort by showing up for a movie. Today, that would be one Instagram post and a trademark tanning oil line. Back then, it was cultural revolution. Now it's a brand pivot. And she rewired pop culture, teaching half the globe how to dress and the other half how to be scandalized. But life is full of plot twists. The woman who insisted, "I gave my beauty to men, now I give my wisdom to animals," also became a recurring headline for saying awful things about people. She loved seals and hated certain humans, which, if you're doing the math, makes her the patron saint of very specific, very French contradictions. That's the weird grief economy we live in. We can admire a jawline in a movie and also point out the bad takes. We will stream contempt for its craft, and then argue in the comment section about her politics, until the algorithm decides we're all experts. The left calls her a feminist icon. The right calls her a patriot. Both will use the same black and white photo on their profile banners and mean very different things. It's the only death where your feed looks like a UN meeting and a yard sale at the same time. Also, Saint-Tropez will now be the place she made famous, which in practice means 6 luxury boutiques, 3 memorial cocktails, and a very specific guided tour called Where Bridget Sat, and you can sit for a price. That is the official First World funeral plan. Mourn subtly, monetize shamelessly. In short, we lost a complicated icon. Our problem isn't that she's gone. Our problem is choosing the correct nostalgic filter for our tribute post.
2 helicopters chose the same sliver of sky above Hamilton on Sunday and unraveled the usual promise of aviation. Lift, speed, escape. They collided at about 11:25 a.m., fell into a field, and left one pilot dead and another fighting for life, while pieces of metal and paper marked the scene like badly stapled evidence. The wreckage looked exactly like a thing that stopped pretending to be useful. Long rotor blades stuck into dirt, a red fuselage peeled open, a white craft burned beyond recognition. First responders did the practical work, airlifting the injured, blocking the field, asking gawkers to step back, while federal investigators readied the paperwork that will make meaning of the collapse. Flight tracks, maintenance records, recordings, witness statements. The meticulous choreography we perform after machines stop following orders. Senators posted sorrow and solidarity from their feeds, as if grief could be subtweeted into closure. Officials promised an investigation, investigators promised a secure facility, and everyone promised to keep you informed until the next public ritual of explanation arrives. This is how modern failure is managed now. Fast color video, slow answers, ritualized sympathy, and a promise that lessons will be learned somewhere else. Later, a pilot is dead. A town watches. Regulators collect debris. The machines that move us continue to be designed, bought, flown, and occasionally collapse into a field while the rest of us file the moment away as another item in a long ledger headed inevitable.
This piece is based on a CNN article titled, "Having a Miscarriage is an Often Untold Story in Women's Health." Now I'm sharing about mine. There's a practical modern truth about grief. You can buy a crib-sized mattress and a brown box and still be unprepared for the emptiness it represents. The author describes a room she couldn't enter for nearly 2 years. Stale air, a changing table, a mattress still in shipping cardboard. It's the perfect domestic absurdity. The future arrived in bubble wrap and refused to stay. Here's the existential problem wrapped in a sonogram. Meaning is easy to assemble when there is a tiny, noisy human to anchor it. Remove the noise and you're left with rituals. Parenting books, onesies, tissue paper, things that suddenly look like props from a play no one cast you in. How much of our identity is built on forthcoming disturbance? How much of our grief measures the difference between expectation and reality? The article gives you the facts. 10 to 20% of known pregnancies end in miscarriage, most in the first trimester, then shows how statistics are both a salve and an insult. Knowing that something is common does nothing for the singular hole it leaves in your chest. Knowing that 50% of people get depressed after a loss helps with policy, not with mascara stains soaked into your pillowcase. Numbers comfort in a museum way. Observe, catalog, keep moving. There's also the social comedy of blame. A surprising number of people will blame the mother, or stress, or that one time she bent over to lift something. Human beings prefer explanations that put responsibility somewhere useful. Anywhere but the chaotic lottery of biology, blame restores a sense of control even when control never existed. It scores guilt, like punctuation, neatly ending the sentence of sorrow with, "You could have prevented this." The poor grammar of grief. Then there's the cheap optimism of strangers. You can try again. Everything happens for a reason. Trying is the fun part. Language tries to soothe by offering replacement parts. Try again sounds less like encouragement and more like a return policy for life. It's as if the universe has a help desk you can lodge a ticket with. The irony is cruel. The ritual of trying again becomes both hope and a way to avoid sitting with the original loss. One of the striking things in the article is how community appears as a contradictory sanctuary. The author calls the pregnancy loss community a hellish club, and also the most loving and supportive group she's known. There's something quietly absurd about finding solace in shared injury. We've been together around the fact that life sometimes removes things we never had the chance to appreciate. We form clubs to mourn the unmourned. The membership is involuntary, the benefits oddly profound. Another existential twist. The body is both betrayer and savior. It hosts potential and then, without fanfare, stops hosting. Then it moves on, healing, getting pregnant again, carrying fear alongside hope for 9 months. The body is a stubborn pragmatist. It keeps trying, and the mind, which insists on stories and meaning, keeps following. This contradiction lets us experience both profound loss and improbable joy. We can love what isn't there and also what arrives later. The mind holds both facts at once and is not obliged to choose. And what of forgiveness? The writer forgives herself, reluctantly, in fits. She writes a letter to a child she never met and apologizes for failing to keep them safe, even though safety was never fully within her power. There is a black humor in apologizing to absence, as if absence were an interlocutor with expectations. Yet that apology is also an honest human attempt to reconcile personal myth with biological randomness. Existential questions remain. Why does pain adhere to memory when the thing that caused it never fully existed in the world? How do we live ethically in the face of randomness? Maybe the real answer is less heroic than we'd like. We keep living because living is what we do. We make rituals, parenting books, walks, makeup, IVF appointments, not because they fix anything, but because rituals give chaos a shape that can be carried. The article offers no tidy philosophy, only a human report. Grief lingers, community helps, luck and biology conspire, and some kind of cautious, unsettled peace becomes possible. That peace is not a conclusion, it's a skill learned amid the absurdity. We continue carrying the invisible children and the visible ones, the laundry of living, the boxes that never got opened. We laugh where we can, cry where it matters, and tell each other, sometimes seriously, sometimes with bitter irony, that continuing is its own kind of meaning.
The capitalist fever dream, Avatar: Fire and Ash, pulled another $64 million domestically and $181.2 million overseas over a single weekend, nudging its worldwide haul to $760.4 million, a sum large enough to be treated like proof that spectacle still rules. The film's $96 million IMAX take is celebrated as evidence that consumers, allegedly price-sensitive, will nonetheless pay for the gilded upgrade. Premium screens become pay-to-play confessionals, where excess is transacted as authenticity. Corporate tentacles snake through the coverage, studios owning newsrooms, theatrical triumphs turned into PR metrics and shareholder cheer. Award season engineering and social media fandom inflate boutique projects into multiplex commodities. A 24's Mardi Supreme migrated from 6 theaters to 2, 600 on Oscar buzz and an online army, converting cultural chatter into box office towns. That pipeline prestige to nationwide profit is less art and more algorithmic product launch. Family-safe franchises and nostalgia-driven remakes sit alongside art house marketing plays. Zootopia 2 inches climbs to $1.4 billion. PG movies outperform PG-13, and Sony's Anaconda reboots a 1997 property into another sales cycle. Every genre is repackaged into predictable release dates and revenue forecasts. Studios treat calendars like factories, schedule, hype, harvest. The corporate spend celebrates best Christmas week since 2020, while the industry still limps behind 2019's $11 billion benchmark. Domestic earnings rose marginally to $8.76 billion in 2025. Anemic growth dressed as recovery. Forecasts promise another $100 million by New Year's, and a 2026 slate engineered to pull theaters back. Super Mario, Toy Story 5, Avengers, Doom. Blockbuster dates penciled in like fiscal quarters. This is not revival, it's consolidation. More spectacle, more formats, more engineered fandom, all feeding the same appetite. The movies are less portals than packaging. Packaged for consumption, priced for scarcity, marketed into mania. Each record and rebound is a symptom. Culture refined into quarterly reports, audiences trained to trade meaning for spectacle, and an industry insisting that the only cure for its decay is ever louder commercial noise.